Hey, it's Motley Fool Money co-host Dylan Lewis here. If you're listening to us, it's because you love following the stock market and learning about business stories. If you're looking to keep learning and unlocking your potential, then you should check out the Think Fast, Talk Smart podcast produced by our friends over at the Stanford Graduate School of Business. Think Fast, Talk Smart is the Webby Award-winning best business podcast that's received nearly 43 million downloads and is the number one career podcast in 95-plus countries, so you know it's worth your time. Each week, host and Stanford lecturer Matt Abraham sits down with experts to discuss the best tips to hone and develop your communication skills, from making small talk that leaves a big impression, to keeping your nerves in check while speaking, to being more persuasive. Whether you're working on your elevator pitch or planning an important meeting, strong communication skills are important in business and life in general. That's why you'll hear from pros like neuroscientist Andrew Huberman on how to manage speaking anxiety, as well as speechwriter, best-selling author, and friend of the Fool, Dan Pink, on how to take risks in your communication, and psychologist Kelly McGonigal on how to harness nervous energy to fuel powerful presentations. All that and so much more available on the Think Fast, Talk Smart podcast. So what are you waiting for? Listen every Tuesday, wherever you get your podcasts or on YouTube.
We've got a closer look at China's economy as well as some uncommon leading economic indicators. Motley Fool Money starts now. I'm Chris Hill. Joining me today, Motley Fool Senior Analyst Bill Mann. Thanks for being here.
Hey, Chris. How you doing?
I am doing okay.
Been outside today?
It's lovely.
I think we need to focus on things like that or days like today. It is lovely outside here in the Northern Virginia part of the United States of America.
Hopefully, wherever folks are listening, it is lovely where they are as well. I want to talk to you about China, but before we do that, without naming names, there are a number of stocks seemingly every day now that are hitting fresh 52-week lows, some of them falling precipitously. And we've seen this in young, unprofitable startups, and we have seen this with the biggest companies in America.
Yeah.
And I wanted to talk to you first about the idea of buying stocks when they are falling, because I am quite confident, particularly in the case of Upstart Holdings and Peloton, two stocks that are not only falling today, they are trading well below where they IPO'd.
Yes.
I am confident that there are investors out there looking at them and thinking, well, come on. I mean, it's below the IPO price. It's a steal at this price. And we don't have to get into those two individually. I'm just using them as examples. I'm curious how you go about the process of figuring out whether something that appears to be selling at a deep discount, whether or not it actually is a deep discount and therefore a time to buy.
It is a foundational question for investing, and it's really hard. It's hard to tell. There is nothing magical about a company's IPO price. That is a contrived event. There's also nothing really magical about a company's all-time high. If you just pick out any company at random, like anyone, and look at the 52-week high and 52-week low, you will see that they tend to be somewhere between 50 and 80% apart from each other. And not just this year, I mean every year, which means that at some point, the stock was 50 to 80% cheaper than it was at a different point in the same year. This happens year in and year out. Now, we don't tend to feel it and we don't tend to sense it because it doesn't usually happen all at once. And usually companies are, as David Gardner is wont to say, the market tends to go up, but it goes down quicker than it goes up. Goes up longer, goes down quicker. We are at a point in time where it's gone down quicker all at once, and it is across the board. And it's not just equities. It's not just U.S. equities. It's global. It is almost everything that's not energy. It's the bond market. So here we are, and we have to make a good decision today, forgetting what the all-time high was, forgetting what the IPO price was. And Chris, I'm here to tell you that the market is fear and greed driven. And now, obviously, fear is at its high. So yes, there are absolutely bargains out there. And you just need to get back to first principles, figuring out what a company has the potential to earn over the long run. And in some ways, what's being offered right now is fantastic.
Was it you who tweeted out over the weekend something about like some of the stocks that you're seeing now are trading, they're trading below their net cash?
Yes. So that was that was speaking about just in the pharmaceutical and biotech segments, but I actually ran another screen. And so what we're looking at here is companies that their market cap is currently below the amount of cash that they have on hand. So in other words, the market is literally expecting them to destroy money, which some companies are good at doing. But right now there are 381 companies on the NASDAQ or the New York Stock Exchange that are trading below net cash, which means, Chris, not that I expect any of them to do this, much less all of them. If all of those companies just said, okay, we're going to stop operating and return your cash to you, you would profit.
You're right. They're not going to do that. But it reminds me of the what Jason Moser and I talked about yesterday with Uber, where the CEO comes out and says, look, we had our earnings report. I was talking to investors and to use his phrase, there's a seismic shift going on, and we are going to cut back on marketing. We are going to treat hiring as a privilege. And you would like to think that at least some of those 381 companies are going to take a page out of his playbook and say, look at how we're being valued right now. What if we stopped lighting money on fire? Or not even
hear me out.
What if we got just a little bit more judicious with the way that we spend money? This might be an opportunity here.
I don't actually really consider that to be great management, though. Right? Like, great management isn't about, hey, what's the market allowing us to do? Let's do that. Right? Great management is all about, this is a way that we are going to try and maximize returns to stakeholders. And the fact that Uber came out and said, well, you know, we're not being allowed to do this anymore by the market, I didn't take that as being awesome. I mean, it's great that they recognized it as opposed to, you know, running the ship into the rocks. But at some point, I think you really want to focus on companies where the managers are good allocators of capital in whatever kind of market. And those companies are out there, and they really do give themselves away by, you know, you're seeing returns on capital, and I know this is really, really great podcast topic, but that are strong year in and year out.
Last question before we move on. Do you expect to see, because again, some of the companies, you look at the stock performance, and I get everything you're saying about like don't anchor to the high or the low necessarily. But some of the companies out there have a lot of cash on the balance sheet.
Yeah.
Is it your expectation that a common refrain we're going to hear over the next 6 months is company X is increasing their share buyback plan because all of a sudden the stock is trading 30% where it was at the beginning of the year? Or is that just going to be on a case-by-case basis?
I actually hope that it's on a case-by-case basis, because if we think about what's great about capitalism is that capitalism at the end of the day is the efficient use of capital. And we are in a remarkable time right now where over the last, let's call it 10 years, just to put a marker down, is that poor uses of capital have not been punished. They really haven't. You have been able to survive as a money-losing company for a long time at this point. So what we're feeling right now is a washout. So what I'm hopeful for is that we will see the truly strong companies doubling down on what they're doing and pressing their advantage. That's where I think real long-term gains are going to come from. I do think you're right. I'm speaking hopeful rather than, you know, what I think will happen. But I think what you're seeing right now is the companies that are going to survive long term should be looking at this time right now and saying, our weaker rivals may not survive this, and that's a good thing for us. And what is a way that we can press our advantage and make that happen quicker than possible? I know, I mean, I know that sounds harsh, but that's the reality of what the markets are supposed to do.
Oh, absolutely. You know, it's like the old saying, when your opponent is drowning, throw them an anchor.
That's right.
increasingly, people are looking at China's economy, looking at the rolling lockdowns, and saying, look, the Federal Reserve can do whatever they want with interest rates. They're not really going to be able to have an impact on what's happening in China. So first and foremost, based on what you're reading and seeing, how concerned are you about China's economy right now?
I think you should be concerned. I mean, there are millions and millions of people who are locked into their houses. I heard anecdotally, but it was to me a pretty good source, that right now in Shanghai, people are not being allowed out of their houses even to collect food, even for food to be delivered, that you must remain inside. So it is severe, and it harms the rest of the global economy, both on the supply side and on the demand side. So we've seen companies like Starbucks has just pulled their guidance. And, you know, an Estee Lauder, which does a huge amount of business in China, have just ratcheted their guidance way down because of the impact of the Chinese economy. I don't actually consider that to be the most dire part of the business, of the whole situation. I mean, ultimately, let's be humans here. The most dire part is that there is a humanitarian crisis going on in a country of 1.4 billion people. And so, you know, ultimately, my hopes are that that it is resolved for them as quickly as possible. But China is still the factory of the world. And for people not to have the freedom to work, to go to factories, that is, you know, that impacts all of us.
So based on that, based on companies like Starbucks cutting their guidance because they don't feel like they can predict what's going to happen in China,
yeah,
should every investor do the same with their own portfolio and just say, look, if American businesses with huge bases of operation in China don't have the vision to see what's coming in the next 6 months, maybe I should just cut my expectations to zero?
I don't think you should. I mean, unless you view what is happening in China as something that is so unpredictable that we could see ourselves years from now with this same problem. I mean, you're talking about something that has gone on for 6 weeks, which is, again, from a human standpoint, that's an eternity. And from a business standpoint, for businesses that rely on just-in-time inventory and they rely on a fully functioning supply chain, that is meaningful. But it's not, you're not talking about something where China is permanently going to be removed from the ecosystem. And you know, the other thing that's interesting to me on the supply side is because China locked down first and earliest in 2020, there were companies like Procter & Gamble that suddenly found 80% of their products unavailable because of what was happening in China. So we are 2 years down the road already of a decoupling. So it is serious. Absolutely, it is serious. I would not worry about the impact of what is going to happen over the next quarter or over the next year as being deeply meaningful in terms of our investing theses for companies that are reliant in one end or the other on China.
What are you going to be watching to give you a sense of, hopefully, the rolling lockdowns coming to an end and China's economy opening back up again?
I think that's ultimately it. I mean, ultimately, at some point, China's going to reopen. And they have taken on a policy of zero COVID, which is not something that almost any other country has done. And I think ultimately it's going to be better if they step back from that. I don't know how they can. So what we have to see now is what we've seen in every other country on Earth, a reduction of the number of cases, the intensity of the demands on the hospital system, and then the country's going to open back up again.
Bill Mann, always great talking to you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Chris.
When it comes to economic leading indicators, you'll find no shortage of analysts willing to talk about things like consumer price index, unemployment rates, and GDP. But if you're looking for something a little off the beaten path, Robert Brokamp and Allison Southwick have got you covered.
If humans were good at predicting the future, we'd all be taking our flying cars to work every day and subsist off of some sort of nutritious sludge prepared by a robot that is very close to calmly losing its patience with us and eradicating our species. Whew! Have you thanked your Alexa today? Anyway, wouldn't it be great if we could predict what is going to happen in the economy or the stock market? I mean, think of all the money we'd make. We could buy all the nutritious sludge we could ever want. So today, we're going to talk about odd little leading indicators that supposedly predict the future health of the economy. And joining us is Mark Reith. Longtime Motley Fool podcast listeners will remember him as the host of Market Foolery and Industry Focus, and he's now with Business Insider. Hello, Mark. It's so good to hear your handsome face.
Hello, hello. How can I invest in nutritious sludge? Because I'm very bullish on that.
You and me both. Let's talk after the show. All right. So the idea for this episode actually came from a member of our Motley Fool podcast Facebook group. And he mentioned the first indicator that we're going to talk about today, and that's the men's underwear indicator or index, the men's underwear index.
Yes, indeed. So the men's underwear index, Alan Greenspan came up with this in 2008. Basically, the concept is that the last thing men buy for themselves is new underwear. No one's looking, and they certainly don't care. Speaking personally, holes upon holes, you know, down here, just mothballs and just terrible, terrible look. So when guys are cutting their discretionary spending, it's often new underwear that's the first thing to go. So this is an index to kind of take a look at discretionary spending. And, you know, maybe you don't bet your entire portfolio on men's underwear, but it is a bit telling in that consumer discretionary stocks are not having a very good year at all in 2022. Consumer discretionary spending is a worrisome prospect at this point, almost halfway through the year. We're seeing a lot of consumer discretionary stocks down. The Consumer Discretionary Select Sector Spider Fund, an ETF that tracks consumer discretionary stocks, is down 20% year to date. And a lot of these consumer discretionary stocks that are being hurt are home furnishing stocks. So like the Bed Bath & Beyonds, the Kirklands, the Williams, Sonomas, that did really well during the pandemic when everyone was trapped at home and staring at their boring walls, you know, deciding what paint color to change it to. Those stocks kind of pulled forward a lot of demand in 2020, 2021. And now we're seeing them struggle in 2022. So consumers across the board are probably not feeling as good as they once were when stimulus payments were coming in, and a lot of consumer discretionary stocks saw great last 2 years, and maybe you're kind of fading a bit this year. Overall, I'm not telling you to invest based on how new your underpants are, but consumer discretionary spending is down. It is a little worrisome as we head halfway into 2022.
All right. So when it comes to accuracy, how would the men's underwear index score on, well, we'll call it the bereathability scale. Get it?
Do we have to call it that?
Yeah,
I don't know if we should call it that.
Let's not overthink it. Okay. So 1 out of 5 thoughtful nods, with 5 being more a higher bereathability scale. What would you give this?
Sure. I haven't stood in the Hanes aisle at my local Target and counted how many guys walked by with new boxers or briefs, no judgment. But signs point to lower consumer discretionary spending ahead. I'm going to give this a solid 3 thoughtful nods on the breathability scale. Maybe you don't predicate your portfolio on men's underpants, but you should probably be aware that consumer discretionary spending is not as hot as it could be.
First of all, it shouldn't be surprising that Alan Greenspan came up with this, because many of you may know he wrote his speeches in a bathtub. So, the underwear was the last thing on his mind before he got into the water. And it's also not surprising, by the way, because I did a little research on this. So we talk about this as men's underwear, but it turns out, according to a research study cited in the Daily Mail, that actually men only shop for their own underpants for 17 years of their lives. Otherwise, it's their mothers and their wives. And we know that Mark is going to get married in 9 days, so his underwear buying behavior is probably going to change. So it's not just a men's purchasing index. I'm going to give it 2 nods of the head. I think there's something to it for sure. I think there's certainly something to people putting off certain purchases when either prices are too high or the economy is slowing down. I just think it's difficult to follow an index that requires you to stand in the underwear section of a store.
I will note that new underpants were part of our vows before we get married. I had to promise new underwear on the horizon. So you're not far off, bro.
We know what to get you as a wedding present, so that's good.
All right, enough about men's underwear. Up next, an economic indicator for the ladies, and that is the lipstick index.
That's right. So the lipstick index was actually brought to us by a guy named Leonard Lauder of Estee Lauder fame, the chairman of the board over at Estee Lauder.
You pronounce that like a man.
I wanted to. You didn't like that?
No, go for it.
Now, Leonard Lauder, the chairman emeritus of the board of Estee Lauder, which is definitely how you pronounce it, came up with this index in 2001, basically to explain why sales of lipstick were up, even though the market was tanking post, tech stock bubble, and the economy was not doing so hot. And his idea is that women buy these kind of cheaper pick-me-up items like lipstick or nail polish instead of spending and splurging on the big ticket items. These smaller items can make you feel pretty and feel good about yourself, and they're relatively cheap to some of the other items out there. And so, lipstick sales go up as the economy goes down. Now, that's an interesting one to pair with the men's underwear index, where, men's underwear sales will go down as the economy loses strength, as opposed to women's lipstick sales going up as the economy loses strength. Either way, the lipstick index has kind of been tweaked over the last couple of years. In fact, Estee Lauder's CEO Fabrizio Frida noted mid-pandemic that women who were staying home obviously cared a little bit less about their appearance. That's a broad generalization, but there's probably something to the fact that, if you're forced to wear a mask all the time, you probably don't care too much about lipstick, right? So lipstick sales at Estee Lauder were down throughout the pandemic, but CEO Freda said that when makeup comes back, consumer sentiment will also come back. And he said that back in August 2020. Here we are in May of 2022. And lo and behold, makeup sales are way up at Lauder. They just announced their earnings like 2-3 days ago. And makeup sales in North America are up 12% year over year, as opposed to skincare sales, which skincare, body lotion, a little bit of self-care, kind of replaced those cheaper, smaller ticket items during the pandemic. Now those skincare sales are going back down. We see makeup sales going back up, maybe a return to normalcy and a little bit of stronger consumer sentiment there. I don't know, if this is the most accurate indicator in the world. I don't know about you, bro, but I stopped buying way less makeup during the pandemic. I was really skimping on the foundation, saved a fortune there. I don't know if I'm ever going to go back in this kind of hybrid remote work world where, maybe I care a little bit about myself and less about impressing everybody out there with this makeup. So for me, in terms of breathability, because apparently we have to say that that now. I'm going to give this maybe 2 thoughtful nods on the scale. I don't think it's as strong of an indicator as the men's underwear index of consumer discretionary spending, basically because the pandemic kind of ruined this index. When you have to wear a mask all day, who cares about lipstick? When you're stuck at home all day, who cares about makeup? Of course, makeup sales are back up. It's just a natural rebound. So 2 thoughtful nods from me.
I'm going to agree with you on that. I'm going to give it 2 thoughtful nods as well. There is definitely evidence that during tough economic times, people do spend a little bit more on small indulgences. Whiskey sales go up, chocolate sales go up, things like that. But you do have to question whether something fundamentally changed in society or the economy to undermine an index. And I think that might be the case here as more people are working from home. Probably will affect all kinds of things, professional wardrobes, office space sales, things like that. I will be curious to know whether 5 years from now, this whole work from home thing will be rethought. But in the meantime, I'm not going to spend too much time on the lipstick index.
Not hanging out in the cosmetics aisle too much. That's probably for the best. All right, let's move on to our next leading indicator, which feels like we're entering sort of self-fulfilling prophecy territory here, and that's with the recession index. And we're going to try not to say the R word too many times to avoid triggering it here. Right, Mark?
That's right. I prefer the R word anyway, because it sounds like an index of piracy. The R word. Ah, porch piracy, perhaps, actually. No, the R word, the recession index, is this old school index created by The Economist a couple of years back, where the idea is that the more frequently the word recession appears in print in the New York Times and in the Washington Post, the more likely it is that a recession actually happened. And you said it very well there, Southwick. You know, the fact that people are saying the R word more frequently can kind of become this self-fulfilling prophecy. You have to ask, are people reading and writing about the R word more frequently because it's more likely to happen? Or are people reading about the R word and thinking that it's going to happen and starting to become a little bit more fearful, maybe pulling their money out of the market and maybe actually causing a recession to occur? That's a question for, you know, the author of The Psychology of Money to answer. But for me personally, I don't fully believe that the R word index is as strong of an indicator as it could be, simply because of this self-fulfilling prophetic nature of the R word. You know, there is a lot of fear in markets right now, and it is kind of warranted given, you know, GDP just fell short of expectations. 2 quarters of bad GDP or low GDP growth means a recession. We have a war in Ukraine. We have rising interest rates. We have sky high inflation. We have supply chain issues. We have COVID zero in China not going as well as it could be. There's a lot to be afraid of right now. And there's a lot of indicators out there that are kind of making people more and more fearful. And I feel like it's really those indicators that are making people talk about recession more and more frequently and making the likelihood of a recession occurring actually a little bit higher. So for me, I'm going to give the R word index maybe 3 thoughtful nods. Again, I feel like the index itself isn't the strongest indicator of whether or not a recession will occur, but I do think it is a lagging indicator of, you know, sentiment in the market and how fearful people are feeling right now.
I'm actually going to give it 5 thoughtful nods.
Oh, here's okay, all right. Here we go.
So I did not find The Economist actually tracking this, even though they're the folks who came up with it. But so instead I turned to Google Trends, which are, you know, Google's only been around since 2004. So we have limited data, but you can see definitely the search on the term recession has spiked. And there've only been a few times when it's been higher so far in the last, whatever that is, 17, 18 years. And the other times were either right before a recession, we've had 2, or during it. So I would say that it is somewhat maybe leading or maybe more coincident. But the reason I'm giving it 5 thoughtful nods is whenever you have an indicator, you have to ask, what am I going to do with this information? And I think anytime there is more talk about a recession, there's probably a good reason. And that's a good reason for you to look at your personal finances and say, you know what, maybe I need to make sure I'm on solid ground and maybe get a little more defensive. Spend a little less, save a little more, maybe check in on your employer. Is your business going well? What's the likelihood that there will be job cuts or pay cuts in the future? What can you do to enhance your human capital to make sure that that doesn't happen to you? So I think it's a good indication when this happens, it's just time to do a little reset and say, okay, let's make sure my finances are solid.
All right, well, Mark, that's all the time we have for today, but you actually have more indicators that you want to talk about. So you know what? Let's do this all over again in the future. What do you say?
Sounds like a plan.
As always, people on the program may have interest in the stocks they talk about, and the Motley Fool may have formal recommendations for or against, so don't buy or sell stocks based solely on what you hear. I'm Chris Hill. Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.